Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we sift through a stack of sources to bring you the most illuminating insights, helping you get well informed quickly and thoroughly.
Really digging in.
Today, we're plunging into the profound and, I think, surprisingly practical world of Ludwig Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations.
It really is practical, isn't it? Not just some dusty philosophy text.
Exactly. It's a radical reevaluation of language, meaning, and even how we understand our own thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
Our mission in this deep dive is basically to unpack Wittgenstein's groundbreaking ideas.
Okay.
We want to show you how they fundamentally challenge our assumptions about how language works.
Which they really do.
How they can dissolve some of these really persistent philosophical confusions and, maybe most importantly, provide a kind of toolkit.
A toolkit, I like that.
Yeah, for clearer communication and thinking in your own life, you might start to understand the very fabric of your thought processes in a, well, a whole new light.
It's quite remarkable, actually, how relevant his central arguments still feel today. You know, many of the problems we run into, both in those big abstract philosophical debates and, frankly, just in our everyday lives,
yeah,
they often come down to a fundamental misunderstanding of how language actually functions, how it works.
Right.
So his work tries to lead us out of what he famously called linguistic bewitchment.
Ah, the bewitchment. Love that phrase.
It is evocative, isn't it? It's like a way to escape being trapped in these conceptual fly bottles.
Yeah.
Just by seeing words in their practical living context, how they're actually used.
So just to put that into context right away.
Yeah.
Imagine maybe constantly arguing about what true justice is.
Okay, yeah.
But without ever actually looking at how the word justice is used in, say, real legal systems or community discussions.
Right, taking it completely out of that practical setting.
Wittgenstein helps us see that the confusion maybe isn't about finding some hidden perfect essence of justice, but it's more about untangling our own assumptions about how the word functions, what job it's doing.
So it's not about dictionary definitions, then?
Not primarily, no. It's about seeing how language works. The main idea, really, is that the meaning of a word isn't, you know, tied directly to the object it might refer to, but it's found in its use, how we employ it within the context of human activity. Language is like a collection of tools, he suggests, not some static system for just picturing reality.
Precisely. And the broader implication there is that Wittgenstein is trying to, well, dissolve many philosophical puzzles.
The kind that keep philosophers up at night.
Exactly. The ones that often pop up when we abstract words from their everyday use. Think about classic questions like, what is knowledge? Or what is the mind?
Okay.
He argues these become so intractable, so difficult, because we treat words like knowledge as if they're labels for some hidden essence, some secret thing.
Right, like there's one definition we just need to find.
When actually, their true meaning lies in how we use them in specific situations to achieve particular goals.
It's quite a journey this book takes you on, and it's maybe even more fascinating when you consider the author himself, Ludwig Wittgenstein.
Oh, absolutely. An incredible figure.
An Austrian-British philosopher, widely seen as one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century. Full stop.
No question.
But what makes him perhaps uniquely positioned to write philosophical investigations is that it's essentially a, well, a powerful public takedown, a refutation of his own earlier work. He's hugely influential Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus.
And that intellectual U-turn, that transformation, is what gives the investigation so much weight, I think.
How so?
Well, the early Wittgenstein, the one who wrote the Tractatus, was utterly convinced that language had this rigid, logical structure that perfectly mirrored reality, a kind of picture theory.
Right. Very precise, very logical.
But then, after years away from academic philosophy, including this fascinating period teaching elementary school in rural Austria, which must have had an impact.
You'd think so.
The later Wittgenstein came to see his earlier work as, well, deeply flawed, fundamentally mistaken.
Wow.
So his authority doesn't just come from his obvious genius, but from this profound intellectual humility. He built this incredibly compelling system, and then he painstakingly dismantled it himself.
That takes some courage.
It really does. He wasn't just critiquing other philosophers. He was critiquing himself with incredible rigor.
I'm talking about a dramatic intellectual pivot.
Mm-hmm.
So the book itself, Philosophical Investigations, published after his death in 1953. It's not like a traditional philosophical treatise, is it?
No, not at all. It reads very differently. It's more like a maybe a sprawling therapeutic journey. That's how some see it.
Therapeutic, how?
Its aim, he suggests, is to cure us of the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language.
Ah, there's that bewitchment again.
It's not about giving us new information or grand theories necessarily. It's more about rearranging what we already know in a way to help us see language and maybe ourselves with newfound clarity.
Okay, rearranging what we know. That raises a question, though. Who is this book really for? Is it just for academic philosophers?
Well, while it certainly engages deeply with philosophical traditions, I think its insights are truly fundamental for anyone who uses language to think and communicate.
So pretty much everyone.
Pretty much everyone, yes. It directly challenges a very foundational Western idea, one often traced back to St. Augustine.
Which is?
That words are simply names for things, that learning language is just about pointing and naming.
The Augustinian picture, he called it.
Exactly. And through this series of really brilliant thought experiments and examples, Wittgenstein just systematically dismantles that simplistic picture. He guides us towards appreciating language's incredible fluidity and, crucially, its dependence on context.
Okay, so to really get how Wittgenstein helps us escape this linguistic bewitchment, we probably need to look at how he tackles these basic assumptions. He starts right at the beginning, challenging that Augustinian picture of language, right?
He does. That simple idea we often just take for granted, how words get their meaning. Augustine, you know, famously described learning language by watching adults point to objects and say the names.
Seems intuitive enough.
It does. But Wittgenstein argues this naming model is actually profoundly misleading. It only describes a tiny, tiny fraction of how language really works in practice.
So how does he counter it?
Well, a key insight comes right away with his famous builder's language example.
Yes, the builders.
Imagine two builders on a construction site. They communicate using just four words. Block, pillar, slab, beam.
Okay.
One shouts a word, say slab, and the other brings the corresponding stone. Now, in this scenario, are the words just names?
No, they're more like orders, instructions.
Exactly. They're orders, they're tools to get a specific job done, and they're completely embedded in a shared activity, a shared context.
Right. The meaning is in the whole interaction.
Precisely. This simple example immediately shows us that language is fundamentally an activity, a practice, not just a list of labels we attach to things.
That really drives home the idea that words are tools.
Uh-huh.
And like any tool, you know, a hammer or a saw,
They're
only really useful when you understand their function, what they do, not just what they're called.
And this metaphor of language as a toolbox becomes absolutely central to the investigations.
Toolbox, I like that.
Just as a hammer, a screwdriver, a wrench, a ruler, all have distinct functions, different jobs.
Right.
So do different words in different kinds of sentences. This really sets the stage for his core thesis. Meaning is use.
Meaning is use. So it's not about what a word is in some abstract dictionary sense.
No.
But what it does, what job it performs in practice.
Exactly. It's about looking at the role a word plays within our language, within our activities.
So zooming out a bit then, this whole first part of the book is fundamentally dismantling the idea that language has just one single uniform function, like naming or describing.
Yes, it teaches us or encourages us to look really meticulously at how words are actually employed, how they're used within specific human activities.
Rather than just assuming they all work like labels or, you know, little pictures of reality.
Precisely. It gets us away from that oversimplified picture theory.
And this idea of language as a practice, as activity, rather than just a static system, that really starts to chip away at some deeply ingrained philosophical habits, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Particularly that persistent urge we seem to have to find the single common essence of things.
Ah, yes, essentialism.
Like trying to find the one defining feature of knowledge or beauty or justice. Wittgenstein argues that this whole search is, well, kind of misguided. And that applies to everyday thinking too, not just philosophy.
He uses that brilliant example of the word game.
Right. What do all games have in common?
Exactly. Think about it. Board games, card games, Olympic games, ball games, video games. What single feature runs through all of them?
Competition. No, some are solitary. Skill. Not always. Amusement. Maybe, but...
See. It's tricky. After exploring various possibilities, rules, winning, losing, amusement, Wittgenstein concludes there is no single essential characteristic common to all things we call games.
So what connects them then? How do we know what a game is?
Instead of a single essence, he says they're related by a complicated network of similarities overlapping and crisscrossing. He calls this family resemblance.
Family resemblance, like members of a human family.
Exactly like that. Members of a family often share features, build, facial features, eye color, temperament, but there might be no single feature that every single member possesses.
But you still recognize them as belonging to that family.
Precisely. There's this network of overlapping similarities.
So what's the practical upshot of this idea for us, for you listening? This seems like a pretty devastating critique of trying to find perfect definitions.
It really is. It tells us, basically, stop asking what is X in that essentialist way.
And instead ask.
Instead ask, how is the word X used? In what various contexts does it appear? What jobs does it do?
Okay. So it frees us from that often fruitless hunt for perfect, rigid definitions.
Yes.
And points us towards describing the actual, often flexible, messy use of concepts in real life. It allows for much more nuance.
Which then leads him to an even deeper challenge, really. If meaning is use and concepts are kind of fuzzy around the edges like game,
yeah,
how do we even know how to use words correctly? Or follow rules consistently.
Ah, the rule-following problem.
Right. He dives into this with the example of someone being taught a mathematical series, like add 2.
Okay, so 2, 4, 6, 8.
Exactly. How does the student know to write 1,002 after they reach 1,000? Why not 1,004, 1,008, or something completely different?
We just know.
Well, we might think there's some private mental formula or intuition guiding them, right? Some inner understanding.
Yeah, that seems plausible.
But Wittgenstein argues that's actually an illusion. Any rule, considered just in isolation, purely abstractly, can be interpreted in countless ways. There's always a way to make any action fit the rule if you interpret it strangely enough.
Right. You know, it's funny how much of life is just following a rule without even consciously thinking about it, like stopping at a red light.
Exactly.
Wittgenstein makes us realize that even that simple act isn't just based on some internal command in my head. It's a profoundly social agreement, isn't it?
Absolutely. So he concludes that following a rule isn't ultimately about some private, internal, mental picture or interpretation. It's a practice. It's a custom. It's a learned technique.
Like learning to ride a bike.
In a way, yes. We're trained to act in a certain way within a community, and our agreement in action, our shared way of doing things, is what constitutes correct rule following. Understanding isn't some mysterious mental process hidden inside. It's the ability to do something, to participate correctly in the practice.
So this shifts the basis of meaning and understanding where? From the private mind to?
To the public, social world, to our shared practices and what he calls forms of life.
Forms of life. What does he mean by that?
Think of a form of life as the fundamental shared background patterns of human activity, culture, biology, and social interaction. They're the bedrock upon which our language games are played and make sense.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Consider the form of life of a legal system.
Hmm.
Within that context, words like guilty or innocent or evidence acquire very specific meanings and uses.
Right. Very different from how a child might use guilty in a playground game.
Exactly. The meaning is embedded in that whole form of life, that whole set of practices and institutions. And this understanding, this grounding in shared practice, leads us to perhaps the most famous and maybe most challenging part of the book.
Which is?
The private language argument.
Okay. Brace yourself. This one can really twist your brain a bit.
It can.
The question is, could a person invent a language just for themselves? A language to refer only to their own private inner sensations, like a specific tickle or pain. A language that, by definition, no one else could possibly understand.
Our intuition might say, well, maybe. Why not? We often assume we have these utterly private, raw sensations that we then just sort of attach labels to internally.
Yeah, it feels like I have direct access to my pain in a way no one else does.
Right. But Wittgenstein argues powerfully that such a private language is impossible. It's conceptually incoherent.
Why? What's the core of his reasoning?
Well, a key insight here is that for a word to have meaning, for it to function as part of a language, there has to be some kind of public criterion, some shared standard for its correct application.
Okay.
So imagine you invent a private word, let's call it S, for a specific sensation you sometimes feel. You write S in a diary whenever you feel it.
Right.
Now, the next day, you feel something. How do you know if it's really S again? How do you know you're using your own private word correctly?
I just remember what S felt like.
But how do you check that memory? There's no external check, no public way to verify if today's sensation is the same as yesterday's S. Your memory itself is just another private event.
So there's no way to distinguish between seeming to use the word correctly
Yeah.
and actually using it correctly.
Exactly. There's no distinction between seeming right and being right in this purely private realm. Without that public framework, that possibility of correction, the rule for using S is meaningless. It doesn't guide anything.
He uses that famous analogy, doesn't he? The beetle in the box.
Yes, brilliant analogy. Imagine everyone has a box, and inside that box is something they call a beetle.
Okay.
But here's the rule. No one can ever look inside anyone else's box. You only know your own beetle.
Right.
Now, the word beetle might get used in conversation. How's your beetle today? But Wittgenstein asks, what does the word beetle actually refer to in this language game?
Well, it can't really refer to the thing in the box, can it? Because no one knows if everyone has the same thing or anything at all.
Precisely. The actual object in the box drops out of consideration as irrelevant. It plays no role in the public use, the meaning of the word beetle. The word might mean whatever is in my box, but it can't refer to the private object itself in a shared, meaningful way.
Wow. So applying that back to sensations like pain.
Similarly, our words for sensations, pain, itch, tickle, get their meaning not by somehow pointing directly to a private inner object or sensation.
But how then?
But from our public outward expressions and behaviors. Things like crying, wincing, groaning, seeking help, saying ouch. These are all part of a shared learned language game associated with pain.
So the language we use to talk about our inner states is actually a public construction. Learned socially.
That's the radical idea, yes. It suggests our inner world isn't some totally private theater inaccessible to others. The very concepts and language we use to recognize, categorize, and communicate our inner states like pain are learned through public interaction.
Through shared reactions, shared ways of responding that are part of our social practice.
Exactly. Without that public framework, that shared form of life, you couldn't even meaningfully refer to pain to yourself, let alone communicate it. The concept wouldn't have any traction.
And what's really thought-provoking is how Wittgenstein then extends these linguistic insights into understanding, well, quite profound psychological concepts. He explores this through the idea of seeing as or aspect perception, especially towards the end of the book.
Right. It's another way he challenges a simplistic view of mental processes. It offers a fresh perspective on ideas like belief, intention, or perception itself.
How does he illustrate this?
Well, placing this in context, he uses the famous duck-rabbit illusion as a perfect example. You know the one.
Yeah, the drawing that can look like a duck or a rabbit, depending on how you see it.
Exactly. We can look at the drawing and see it as a duck, or shift our perception and see it as a rabbit. The physical lines on the paper don't change.
But our perception, our experience, does.
Right. And this dawning of an aspect, as he calls it, isn't just a raw sensation hitting our eyes. It's a change in how we organize what we see. And that organization is deeply intertwined with our concepts and our language, our concept of duck, our concept of rabbit.
So perception isn't just passively receiving information.
No, he suggests it's an active process shaped by how we talk about, categorize, and understand the world. Our concepts influence how we even see.
Okay, after this incredible journey through some really mind-bending ideas, what are the biggest takeaways? The core messages from philosophical investigations for you, for our listeners?
Well, for me, number one has to be meaning as use. It's just fundamental.
Yeah, that's huge. It changes how you approach language entirely. Don't just look for the dictionary definition as the final word.
Right. Look at its function, its role, how it operates in the vibrant drama of actual human life. Ask, what job is this word doing here?
Okay, meaning is use. What else?
Tied closely to that are language games and forms of life. Recognizing that language isn't one single monolithic thing, but it's countless different activities, innumerable different games, each with its own sort of context-dependent rules, all embedded in our culture, our biology, our shared existence, our forms of life.
So to genuinely understand a word or a statement, you have to grasp the human context, the specific game being played.
Absolutely, which decisively challenges that older idea, maybe from the Tractatus, that all language has some single underlying logical structure.
Got it. Then there's the rejection of essentialism, that hunt for the single defining feature.
Replaced by family resemblance, yes. Concepts are more like a rope made of many overlapping fibers, not a chain where every link shares one single property.
Which allows for so much more flexibility and nuance in our thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
It frees us from that often futile search for rigid, perfect definitions that cover every single case.
Exactly. And another key one for me is the therapeutic role of philosophy.
How he saw philosophy's job.
Yeah. not primarily about building grand abstract theories, but as a method, a way to untangle knots in our thinking, often knots caused by language itself. His famous aim, to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle.
I love that metaphor. It's about achieving clarity, dissolving confusion, not necessarily discovering new empirical facts.
And that's captured beautifully in one of his most famous lines. Philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language.
It really frames philosophy as a practical tool, doesn't it? A tool for achieving a kind of everyday intellectual freedom.
It does. And then, of course, there's the profound implication of the private language argument, the rejection of a purely private mental world.
Yeah, that really flips the script on how we think about our own thoughts and feelings.
It links them inextricably to our public social world. Our inner lives aren't sealed off in some black box. They are shaped by and understood through the very language we've learned within our communities.
So my ability to even think about my feelings depends on this shared public resource of language.
That's the suggestion. And it also connects back to his insight that rule following is a social practice.
Right, not just an internal calculation.
Our ability to think logically, to follow rules, to reason, it isn't some mysterious internal mental process alone. It's grounded in our training, our participation in shared social customs and activities. Agreement in judgment and action is the very foundation.
Okay, so to bring these powerful ideas really to life, maybe we can touch on some memorable lines or key encapsulations from the book.
Definitely. Well, the most succinct summary, as we've said, has to be, the meaning of a word is its use in the language.
Simple, direct, yet incredibly profound in its implications. Look at the use.
It really is. It's a constant reminder. Look, don't just assume you know based on the word itself. Another one that resonates deeply, especially with the form of life concept,
yeah,
highlighting how much shared context matters. If a lion could talk, we could not understand him.
Mm. Why not? If it spoke English?
It's not just about translating the sounds. It's about the complete lack of a shared world, shared concerns, shared activities, a shared way of being. The underlying meaning, the language games they'd be playing, would likely be utterly alien to our human form of life.
Wow. Okay. That really underscores the form of life point. What about his method?
A great one summarizing his therapeutic approaches. What we do is to bring words back from their metaphysical to their everyday use.
Taking them off the pedestal.
Exactly. Grounding abstract philosophical terms back in the messy practical reality of human life where they originated and where they do their work. It's like reminding ourselves what a tool is actually for rather than just admiring it on a shelf.
I like that. And the beetle.
Ah, yes. The core idea of the private language argument is captured so well by the beetle in the box analogy. The key part being, if everyone has a box with something they call a beetle, but no one can look in anyone else's box, the word beetle could not be the name of the thing in the box. Why? Because.
The thing in the box drops out of consideration as irrelevant.
Yeah.
To the meaning of the word. Exactly. It just highlights so clearly how meaning requires public criteria, public checkability, not just private intention or feeling. So, okay, let's bring this home. What does all this mean for you listening right now in your real life? Are there practical applications?
Oh, absolutely. Profound ones, I think, across the board. For starters, think about improved communication and conflict resolution.
How so?
Well, think about how many arguments in personal relationships, at work, online, stem from people using the same word. Maybe fairness or respect or success.
But meaning subtly different things by it, playing different language games.
Exactly. So instead of getting bogged down arguing about the single true definition, Wittgenstein's approach encourages you to ask, wait, what do you mean by that? How are you using that word in this specific situation? What does success look like for you in this context?
Ah, so it shifts the focus from abstract definitions, which can be unresolvable,
to concrete practices, examples, and contexts. And often you find the disagreement isn't as deep as it seemed, or it's about something different entirely.
That could be incredibly useful. What else?
It definitely enhances critical thinking. When you encounter abstract, often loaded terms in politics, advertising, even just daily news,
yeah,
you can now ask, okay, what language game is being played here? Who is using this word in this way? And for what purpose? What are they doing with this language?
So it helps you resist that linguistic bewitchment,
yeah,
see through rhetorical tricks, maybe.
Precisely. It gives you a tool to analyze how language is being deployed.
What about something like problem solving?
Well, instead of always searching for the single root cause of a complex problem, the idea of family resemblance encourages a different approach.
Which is?
Mapping out the whole network of overlapping interconnected factors, seeing the family of issues involved rather than assuming one single essence. This can lead to more realistic and nuanced solutions.
Personally, for self-understanding.
The private language argument has big implications there. It suggests that understanding our own emotions, our own inner states, isn't something purely innate or discovered entirely in isolation.
But it's learned.
It's deeply learned through language and social interaction. Naming and talking about our feelings isn't just expressing something pre-existing. It's fundamental to having and understanding those feelings in a structured, meaningful way. It shapes how we experience our very inner lives.
So summing up, the most valuable lesson, maybe, from philosophical investigations, is this fundamental shift in perspective.
I think so. Language isn't just a static mirror reflecting the world out there. Yeah. It's a diverse set of dynamic tools that we actively use to navigate, interact with, and, in a sense, build our world together.
And meaning isn't found hidden in a dictionary entry.
But it's forged in action, in use, within our communities, within our shared forms of life.
So this deep dive hasn't given you, the listener, ultimate answers to life's biggest questions. That wasn't really Wittgenstein's goal.
Yeah.
But hopefully, it has equipped you with a powerful method for thinking more clearly. A way to untangle intellectual knots, dissolve linguistic confusion, and maybe see the world less impeded by the illusions language can sometimes create.
He really does bring philosophy back down to earth, doesn't he? Back to the rough ground, as he called it, of everyday human life.
Absolutely. So maybe a final provocative thought for you to consider on your own.
Go for it.
How many of your own disagreements, whether they're in personal relationships, professional settings, or even just those debates you have in your own head, might simply be a result of you and the other person, or even different parts of your own thinking playing different language games without realizing it, using the same words, but for different purposes, with different implicit rules?
That's a powerful question. What if clarity isn't always about finding the single true definition?
Right. What if it's more about understanding the different uses, the different contexts, the different games being played? How might adopting that perspective change your next conversation, or how you approach a tricky problem, or even just how you understand your own thoughts and feelings?
Lots to think about there.
Indeed. This was The Deep Dive, bringing you closer to being truly well-informed. We encourage you to keep questioning, keep exploring, and keep understanding the fascinating world around you.